Welcome to Grounded Wellness, your go-to podcast for simplified and trusted information on how to live a more non-toxic and holistic life. We're your hosts. I'm Bethany McDaniel, founder of Primally Pure, biohacking enthusiast and mom of three.
And I'm Courtney O'Connor, holistic esthetician with over 15 years experience in the healing power of touch and holistic skincare rituals.
In today's episode of Grounded Wellness, I had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Cameron Chestnut, a world-renowned plastic surgeon known for his unique holistic approach to cosmetic procedures and skin treatments. This conversation will touch on the hottest trending topics in plastic surgery and dermatology, including his unpopular opinion on filler and why we're now seeing an epidemic of overfilled and swollen faces. And the number one thing that most plastic surgeons get wrong. I can't think of a better person to guide us through this conversation of aging gracefully and optimally. Let's dig in. Dr. Chestnut, thank you so much for hosting us here in your backyard, literally in your backyard in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. This is so beautiful. And I'm really excited to chat with you today. I want to get into your background and what sets you apart as a plastic surgeon. But first, I want to hit on a topic that I know you talk about a lot and you get a lot of pushback on, and that is filler.
Absolutely.
What are your concerns with the filler epidemic right now?
Yeah, well, I'll just say welcome to my home. Thank you for coming. And I'm glad we got such a beautiful day. And thanks for making the trip out. Filler is a topic that I talk about a lot. It's controversial, it's hot, but it's a really great place to kick off, I think, any conversation about, let's just say, cosmetics or plastic surgery or aging even. And filler is not a bad thing. Filler, I think we need to define what it is. There's a bunch of different categories of filler, and this can be very confusing as to what it is. Filler is not Botox. That's a whole different animal and whole different category. Fillers are, let's just generalize, injectables that are meant to add volume to the soft tissue of our face, to the fat pads, to the skin, whatever it is of our face. The most common one, the one that everybody really thinks of, are hyaluronic acid fillers. And hyaluronic acid is a normal part of our skin, a very minor part, but a normal part of our skin that holds water. It's part of the extracellular matrix. And that gets kind of cross-linked. They take it and they'll cross-link it and they'll turn into a gel that we can inject into our face. That gel goes into fat pads and it's meant to add volume, right? But there's other types of filler as well that we call biostimulants. These get injected to stimulate the creation of collagen. That's like, sounds very awesome. Oh, we inject it and it creates collagen. But we have to think of, okay, well, how much of our face is actually made out of collagen? Do we really want to be creating collagen in places where maybe it's not supposed to be, which can be one of the issues with it.
And what are some examples of those? Like Sculptra?
Sculptra would be the quintessential biostimulant, but there's one called Radies as well that's actually calcium that gets injected, like a component of bone, calcium hydroxyapatite is called actually, but that stimulates, has a little bit of a biostimulant effect. And so we'd call those like semi-permanent to permanent fillers. That's what they get categorized as. And interestingly, the hyaluronic acids get categorized as a temporary filler. That's where things get, it's like a perfect segue and kickoff into where things go wrong. So fillers are not bad in and of themselves, but they're just so commonly misused. The reason they're commonly misused, in my opinion, is just a lack of understanding. I like to think of this as that people just don't know, as opposed to that they're maliciously using them wrong. And you can go anywhere, like within here, we can go five places within a mile or two and get filler injected. It's so easy to access it. And it seems so great. Like, oh, I'm aging. I notice a little change. Right. I get this injection and everything is fixed, right? Like, right. What a magic wand. But the issue is, very little, or how about only some of our aging changes are related to volume loss. So there's issue one. So if your only strategy to combat your aging is to add volume, you're missing a lot of other things that are going on, especially if you're overdoing that one to make up for the others. That's when people start looking funny, right? And then there's just the misunderstandings about the product itself. Like I just said, it's considered a temporary solution, a temporary injectable. Like it lasts 6 months or 18 months, and then it goes away and you have to do it again. That's really problematic mindset and a really problematic application, because filler lasts decades, even the hyaluronic acid ones.
And you've seen this
in practice. I see this every day in practice, where fillers, I just had it last week. Oh, this is filler's 30 years old, still there. And I take it out during surgery and I have to remove it with ultrasound guidance, and it's an issue.
So, and people are still saying that it only lasts 6 months.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's where I think the misunderstanding really comes in. And then there's a safety blanket idea around it that, like, well, if you don't like it, you just get it dissolved, right? Like, this is another magic wand solution. You get the magic wand, you don't like what it does, you use the next magic wand and it just goes away. And that's this enzyme called hyaluronidase that breaks down hyaluronic acid. It doesn't work that well. Depends on the type of filler, depends on how long it's been there, where it's placed, all kinds of things like that. But you don't just put that enzyme in and everything magically goes away. Maybe some of it does, maybe some of it doesn't. There's a lot of issues with just using this magic wand. It doesn't make it go away.
And then do you also risk dissolving some of your own hyaluronic acid that your body makes naturally?
Okay, so this is a super controversial hot topic. You have a school of thought that is vehemently saying no. Like, if you dissolve any of your own hyaluronic acid, you just remake it, it's no big deal. So there's no issue with dissolving at all. And that may be true if you're really young and creating a lot of hyaluronic acid. In your 20s, you make a lot of it. In your 60s, you don't make as much, right? So most of us are in that transition phase somewhere between those. Then you have a group who is very passionate on the other side, mostly because they've experienced something where they had dissolution and they lost native volume, whether it was in their fat pads or their skin, and they notice a change that is very disturbing to them. And so you have these very discrete camps that are very passionate about their stances. And I feel like many things in life, that the truth usually lies somewhere in the middle of these two extremes, where for some people it may be okay to get dissolution, for others it could be problematic. And anecdotally, the thing that I see the most is when people get a lot of dissolution in too high of doses and too high of frequency, they have trouble recovering because they're constantly getting blitzed with this enzyme to dissolve.
Makes sense.
If it's done conservatively in the right time frames, we can recover between each one. And so I do believe that if misused, there can be issues, but for most people, it's not an issue. That's kind of my stance.
And do you see even people that have used this enzyme, hyaluronidase, who come then to see you and they still have filler? Do you see that?
100%. Okay. Yes. And this is where I say it doesn't work that well. And there's more factors. There's the actual interaction of the enzyme with the filler that is okay, breaks down some of it, but not all of it. And then there's just the idea that filler does not stay in place. And this is a whole nother issue with it. Filler migrates, it moves. No question about it. People will argue that. Filler gets in the muscles of facial expression that we have in our face. Our entire face is laced with this very intricate array of muscles in different directions that help us emote and animate and show emotion and non-verbally communicate. And when we put filler in our face, some of it gets in those muscles and it moves. It's a pumping action. And so part of the reason that the enzyme doesn't work for a lot of people is it's just put in the place where the filler is no longer at. I most commonly see this in the lips. I most commonly see this under the eyes. Those are the two areas where the pumping mechanism really, really affects where the filler goes. I did a study with one of my fellows a couple of years ago where we looked at 50 consecutive women who are having what's called a lip lifting procedure, where there's an incision under the nose. And those 50 women had had filler injected in the lips, in the pink part of their lips. And 49 of those 50 women had filler that had moved all the way up to the base of their nose. So it moves, and it moves quickly. It, you know, some of those were like 6 months or less, and it was already at the base of their nose. So something that we need to consider, you know, if you get filler, like let's say you're in your 20s and you get filler in your lips, that's totally fine. You know, you can do that. It's no longer probably rejuvenating from an aging standpoint. You're probably just augmenting at that point. It'd be like getting breast implants, you know, like you're just changing where you were before. And that's totally fine if that's your decision. But you have to understand that filler is going to move and migrate. And if you're getting it every 6 months, you're just kind of backfilling it as it's migrating away.
And then where does it, and then it just lands there above, like below the nose and
yeah. So it sort of distributes, this is just physics and chemistry a little bit. That muscle is this sort of circular sphincter type of muscle around our mouth that helps us purse our lips. And eventually it just kind of fills that muscular space and it just evenly distributes itself throughout the muscle. So the more you do it, and we see this, you'll see this in women's lips, they just get thicker and thicker and the movement changes a little bit. If I were to put a bunch of filler inside of my bicep and just fill it up, it wouldn't contract the same anymore. Mm-hmm. So the same thing happens with these very important muscles that we are very in tune to. And what I mean by that is we have parts of our brain that are very receptive to what's happening with somebody else's facial expression. They're parts of our temporal lobe that recognize age, emotion, beauty, if you're going to hurt me, who you are from an identity standpoint. So we're really, really in tune with those changes. And so when there's minor alterations in them with something like Botox, which moves, changes muscular movement, or with filler that fills up muscles, it can be a little bit alarming. It sets something off
in
our brain.
All those subtle cues that we don't even necessarily like recognize, but we still detect them as we're talking to someone.
There's a lot of aha moments here with people where They see something, it registers as odd or unusual. They don't even know what it is until we articulate it, and then they can put their finger on it. That's what it is. That's what those funny lips are all the time. Yep.
I've also heard you talk about how filler can attract volume over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, this gets back to what the purpose of hyaluronic acid is in our skin. It's called the glycosaminoglycan, which is sugar linked to amino acids, basically, and it attracts water, right? That's its purpose in the extracellular, so outside of the cells in our skin. It lives in the outside space surrounding them, and it attracts water. And it gives trigger and helps with, you know, filling things up. And so it has some volumetric properties. So it's meant to attract water, right? So now if you cross-link it and break it into the, put it into this gel and you inject it, as that gel is present, it attracts water, but it's pretty compact. But as it breaks down over time and starts to spread out, more surface area of it gets exposed and it attracts more water. So we know that, interestingly, over time, as the filler breaks down, it can actually bring more volume and water to itself than what it was originally injected as.
Wow.
So you'll see somebody who had 10 syringes of filler done over time, but they have 26 cc's of volume now from fluid. That was not what it was meant to do.
Is that what's happening with the pillow face phenomenon, or are people, is that more like perception drift where people are deciding to inject more and more filler because their perception of themselves is like resetting every time they get it, and then they just think they need more and more?
Yeah, that's a really great point. It's multifactorial. It's both of those. There's the initial perception drift, and just to define what that is, you said it really well. You recognize yourself in the mirror when you look in there. If I were to drastically change you overnight and you went in the mirror tomorrow, you'd be alarmed. Like, oh my gosh, what happened? I don't look like myself. And we see that even when people get just like hay fever or colds or allergies, your eyes swell and you look different. You're like, oh my gosh. Well, when you get little changes, let's say every 6 months or every year, you get a little filler here and a little more filler. You get time to adjust to that new look in the mirror, and that becomes your new North Star. You know, that's your new identity of yourself. But if you keep doing that over and over and you keep shifting away from this norm, you get to a point where now you're used to looking in the mirror and that's your normal self. But if you really flash back to where you started, you're completely different looking. And this is one of these aha moments that people have where somebody tells or says something to them, or they just kind of have this realization when they see an old picture, or they just have that day where they look and they're like, oh my gosh. That's where I think this downstream part of the filler actually attracting more water over time, that change starts to pick up a little bit.
Yeah.
And you now have more volume than you ever had. The perception has drifted even more and you have this realization. I see a lot of people at that point where they've kind of realized, like, I don't look like myself anymore. I wish I wouldn't have done this. It was the wrong strategy. And it just got out of hand. It wasn't bad at first. It just got out of hand a little bit.
Yeah. So it's a culmination of all those things. Right. And we have so many injectors now that are able to do this that, in my opinion, also are kind of like lacking the artistry that should be required, I think, to like appropriately handle these things. Mm-hmm. But they're just so accessible. I think they're pretty inexpensive,
right?
Somewhat affordable,
right? Things, yeah, they really are. And you know, you bring up a good point with the injectors, is that it doesn't take as much training, or really any, compared to what people would understand. And anybody that you look at online is the best injector, an expert injector, right. A master, whatever, like their mom wrote their bio for them type of thing, you know. And it's interesting in the perception drift idea. I've really been sort of articulating and thinking about this idea that's not as well defined, but I believe those injectors are getting sort of a double dose of this perception drift, because you look at them and you see their own perception, like for who they are.
Yeah.
A lot of injectors you'll look at and be like, you've drifted personally.
Yeah.
But then they're getting the second feedback mechanism of their patients coming into them. So their patients drifting and they're getting a double dose in the mirror and with every patient who thinks, oh, I look great, I'm really happy with how I look, they're just drifting. And so they're getting multiple avenues of this feedback that I think sort of accelerate that type of perception drift for the injectors. But again, I don't think that any of it's malicious.
Yeah.
This is like Hanlon's razor. It's like, it's not malice, it's just that they don't understand,
right.
You know, that makes them kind of misuse it a little bit.
What about lymphatic blockages? Mm. How do fillers impact our lymphatic system in the
You're
face?
You're hitting all the things. Yeah, so this is important. It's important in daily life, and it becomes really important for me in the surgical setting, because the filler breaks down, right? Our body breaks it down naturally, enzymes break it down, and it goes from this relatively cohesive, tangible amount of filler that's cross-linked together as a gel, and it breaks into smaller particles, and that gets drained out via our lymphatics. And it does cause lymphatic drainage issues. It plugs and changes them. Now, there's different ways it can do this. There's the mechanical part of just plugging the lymphatic. It can't drain water the same. It's like having a slow draining drain, right? But then there's the idea that it actually could injure or fibrose those lymphatics so they don't work as well in the long term. This is where things get really concerning. There is no definitive answer to this. I don't know that it's damaging the lymphatics, but I do know that it gets in there. And that is why you may have had filler 8 years ago, 10 years ago, and you get a bout of hay fever, or you get a cold, or you get your teeth cleaned. And this happens all the time. This happened with the COVID vaccines, where people's filler started lighting up. Well, our immune system is recognizing it. It's a foreign body that's floating freely in our face. And our immune system knows that it's there. And when it gets turned on for something else, it will also go after the filler. So really commonly, people's filler will swell, and it will get tender to touch after they've had some other systemic issue going on, especially if it's in their face, right? So we know that the immune system's attacking it, but then the inflammation that brings, the fluid takes longer to drain in those normal situations. So their face is swollen for longer. In my surgical practice, when I am managing filler and taking care of it, there's three main things that I talk about that will make your swelling last longer. Prior surgery, if you're a little bit older in age, but the biggest one is, have you had prior filler at any time in the past? 30 years ago, 10 years ago, yesterday, it does not matter. You will have more swelling for a longer period of time if you have filler in your face, because the filler attracts water, it plugs lymphatics, they don't drain as well. It is very tangible and very obvious in those situations what it does.
What percentage of your patients would you say have had filler?
85 to 90.
Wow.
Yeah.
As I'm hearing you talk about this, I'm just thinking, why are people still doing this? Like, it does not sound like there is an upside. It sounds like there are way more downsides than there are benefits.
And again, this is where I get into, like, filler isn't bad. Injectors aren't bad. It is readily accessible. It seems like an easy first place to go. It's not that expensive.
But so misunderstood.
It is very misunderstood, right? And that's where things get out of hand. When the 90% is all comers, right? And that may be even low a little bit. It's really the question I would ask is, like, well, how many people has it gotten out of hand with and become problematic? Because when I have my filler patients, this is one of the questions on my intake form. Have you ever had prior filler? Question one, almost 90%+, yes. Have you ever had it dissolved? Because then that tells me, was there an issue with your filler? Do you not like where it is? Yeah. And so I would say of those 90%, about half of them, the filler is problematic enough that it is one of our metrics of success, that we need to get rid of that filler to have a positive result with our overall, versus the other ones, it's just sort of present, it's there, it's not an issue. We know it might become an issue over time. So in those cases, I'm usually managing the filler a little bit more conservatively and then replacing it with something like fat transfer that I think we'll end up talking about at some point.
Yeah.
But it's easy to get to. And I don't know that it's well understood enough to have everybody not do it. Like, by the time somebody finds me, generally, like, I'm at an upper echelon, right? By the time they find me, nobody's just coming right to me from scratch. You know, they're usually kind of worked their way up through this, oh, I noticed a little aging. What's the easiest thing to do? You know, that's how they're coming to me usually.
I want to go back to Sculptra.
Mm-hmm.
What are the potential risks with Sculptra? I know you mentioned that the idea is that it increases collagen, but I think there's a little more to it than that.
Yeah, there is. And Sculptra is, again, not an all bad option. We have to understand how it works. It's poly-L-lactic acid, which is something that we use versions of in, like, sutures and bony anchors and things like that. So it's used all over medicine. It dissolves. It gets broken down via really a foreign body reaction. So in some sense, you inject Sculptra. People are going to argue with this, but this is what happens. You inject Sculptra, we get a foreign body reaction to it, and that walling off this foreign body, creating it, we make more collagen in the process. So one end sounds really sexy, one end sounds really like, ugh. But again, truth lies in the middle, right, as to where that is. So you inject this in the face. People talk about it as a fat transfer alternative. And this goes with filler, too. You find a lot of filler, and you find that is the only strategy, because that's the only tool that person has. And so when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? Sculptra is the same way. Sculptra is a great fat transfer alternative if you don't do fat transfer, right? Because it can go all over your face diffusely, create collagen. People put it in the fat pads, they put it under the skin, and it just creates this blanket of fibrosis. Fibrosis meaning almost like scar tissue in a way, right? It's collagen. Scar tissue is made out of collagen too. And so, again, not all bad, but when it gets overused, or when you're planning on maybe having surgery someday, if I have somebody who's had a lot of Sculptra, I look at their surgery as working through a prior surgical procedure, which has scar tissue in it. I know that I'm going to encounter that. In this case, normally as I'm working in, you know, separating out these tissue layers, it's very delicate. They're meant to be separated in that. They're these embryologic fusion planes. So it kind of was like opening the page of a book. It goes pretty easy. When somebody's had Sculptra, it's like you dumped that book in glue and now everything's kind of pasted together. It's really hard to pull those pages apart, right? And I'll see, I call them like weld points. I'll see these like balls of scarring fibrosis that are kind of like holding things together. And so I see it, and number one, it makes the surgery really difficult, but I'm also just thinking like these are meant to be glide planes where fat and skin and muscle move over each other, and they're now welded together.
Yeah.
So I just...
It's almost like we can't really know yet like what the implications of that are. Right. Like our tissue was created in a certain way and with a certain structure, and we're creating, it sounds like, just a lot of scar tissue and changing that structure. Yeah. And like, I wonder, what does that do to the lymphatic system? Like... just what does that do to the health of the tissue in general?
Yeah, and it's just unnatural adhesions. You know, I think the argument in there is like, well, you know, something like surgery is unnatural too. Or what about fat transfer? Well, fat transfer goes into fat pads. So
let's talk about fat transfer.
Yeah,
tell us what fat transfer
is. So fat transfer is the idea of borrowing fat from somewhere else on your body, and there's a bunch of places you can take it from, just totally depends, and then using that fat to volumize somewhere else. We're gonna talk about facial applications today because that's what I do. Fat transfer works really beautifully on the face, where the fat pads of our face are what's responsible for most of our volume loss. So the percentage of our aging that is attributed to volume loss is mostly inside of those fat pads. Great, an easy target to replace them. Our fat pads are also very structural in our face. Everything's functional, right? In our face, the fat pads are meant to be glide planes for the muscles. So you'll find fat pads between our skin and our muscles, and you'll find fat pads underneath and between muscles so that they can glide in their individual directions very smoothly and very easily, right? Well, from just the way that our social brains work and beauty and things like that, we can also tell a lot about how old somebody is, or again, all these things based off of, well, what's the volume of your fat pads? That's creating the superficial contours of our face, basically.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone ever thinks that way of like, oh, let's, what does this person's volume of their fat pads look like? But it's like so fascinating because our brain recognizes it, even though we can't really articulate like why someone might look older.
Yep. And it's just a byproduct of that other attunement that we have that's really, you know, technical in the different parts of our brain. Again, there's emotional parts of our brain and our amygdala, and there's facial recognition. There's all kinds of parts that really tune into this. And those fat pads are wildly important to that, because as your muscle moves, it's actually moving the fat pad on top of it, you know, or if it's connecting to the skin, there's all kinds of ways. But so fat transfer goes into those fat pads, right? And it sounds very simple. We'll just take fat out and put it in. And that is how some people do it. They'll just straight take it out, put it in. I like to get a little bit more regenerative and progressive with my approach. And what I mean by regenerative is our fat is also one of our greatest sources of mesenchymal stem cells. It's our bone marrow and our fat, wildly rich in stem cells, if we really break it down. So when I'm taking fat, I'm selecting the stem cell dense portion of it, which is different for every person. Younger, healthier people have a higher percentage than somebody who's older and unhealthy. And I'm using that fat to put in these fat pads. So now we get the volume that the fat pads are missing. They can only take so much volume. You can't or don't want to overdo it. So
Some people overdo it with fat transfer? Is that even possible?
Yes, you can overdo it with fat transfer. It's more difficult than it is with filler because there's some built-in stop point that if I just put way too much fat in, it won't survive, right? It has to have a blood supply to it. And that's one of the limitations with it, right? That's why our face is also great, because our face has wonderful blood supply. And if you're using stem cell dense fat, it has a better capacity to create its new blood vessels to itself, because those stem cells are what orchestrate all the survival, right? They also will rejuvenate the structure of the fat pad. Like I was saying, the fat pads have a purpose. And if I were to take a 20-year-old's fat pad and hold it right here, it's structural. It's like honeycomb with fat in it. If you take an 80-year-old's fat pad, it is very gelatinous. It's jelly. It's lost a lot of that structure. So we're trying to slide that fat pad back into its structural phase. So you get this double benefit. You don't have to overvolumize, because I don't have to blow this thing up like an overinflated balloon to make it structural again. I can just build some of the inherent bones back into it, if you will, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And this is something that you're actually going to be doing on me later.
Yes.
Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to it. I think it's exciting.
Awesome. I mean, like, and rightfully so, people are going to look at you and say, you're beautiful. What are you doing? Why are you doing anything? You don't need to do anything. And, you know, that's a subjective view through somebody else's lens. But when we talk about something like fat transfer that we're going to do, I'm going to go through every single fat pad on your face, literally every single one, and I'm going to assess it. How much volume does this need? Does this need any volume? What about the structure? And we may do 5% on some, and we may do 25% volume on some, just totally depending on what your individual needs are. But that allows us to be comprehensive. It allows things to be cohesive, that things to move as a unit, and to be sort of very individualized in what we're doing. And then you're getting this like mild regenerative benefit and this mild volumetric benefit, and that is yours. That's going to stay. It's not going to be drastic at all, but you will now, moving into the future, age in a much better way than something like filler, right? That we know is mm-hmm. probably going to go the other direction a little
yeah.
bit.
And yeah. And yeah, like because of the stem cell rich mm-hmm. density of the fat, I think you said that will like continue to regenerate. Not, it provides a little bit of like plumpness, but also will regenerate the skin and improve right. skin health over
yeah.
time.
Yeah. So there's this idea of paracrine secretion, it's called. It's how cells communicate with one another via growth factors, basically, or exosomes. They release these exosomes that are little envelopes full of growth factors, and that's how stem cells communicate. Well, those stem cells that we're going to put in your fat pads are directly adjacent to your skin. And so even over years, you will notice that your skin health will improve just from the fat transfer alone because of that paracrine communication with the stem cells of your skin.
Wow.
It's really cool.
That's super cool and yeah. very next level.
Very, very next level. And it takes a little effort. Like the norm is to, like I said, take the fat out, put it in. Very simple, very straightforward, very quick. And when I see that, I just...
like a missed opportunity.
It is. It's like, yeah. it's not, I'm not going to say low hanging fruit, but you're leaving a lot of fruit on that tree by just kind of like picking the low stuff and moving on. There's so much more there. And I think if you think that way and have that value system and understand the regenerative component, you can do quite a bit with it.
Yeah. And is that kind of the norm, like of what most plastic surgeons would do? They would just take the fat, put it somewhere else, end
yep.
of story.
Yeah. And part of that is, when we think about where else fat transfer is used for body fat transfer, like mm-hmm. a Brazilian butt lift, or sometimes to breast tissue for mm-hmm. like a fat-based breast augmentation, those areas, it's different putting fat there. They have different blood supplies. It's not nearly as robust as our face. The fat pads are less well-defined, so it doesn't have the same outcome, so they'll put much higher volumes. Just to put in reference, when we're talking about fat transfer, I'm talking about tens of cc's. Like small amounts, right? And I'm harvesting tens of cc's. For a fat transfer to a butt or a breast, you might be harvesting thousands of cc's or transferring hundreds of cc's. Totally different orders of magnitude that we're talking about. And so that's just sort of like get as much in there as you can and keep your fingers crossed that it survives. Whole different ball game, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the nice parts about the face. It's more intricate. And this is the theme of, I think, all facial plastic surgery. It's more intricate. It's more detailed. It's more nuanced. But we can also have a much greater impact with little changes there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about your unique approach. What would you say differentiates you the most from other plastic surgeons in your field?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is that sort of progressive mindset. You know, I'm striving and seeking the next level all the time for myself, for my patients. The short answer to this is results. That's what it really boils down to. That's where why I am who I am is that when you look at results, you see them, you resonate. I like that. I can't even tell what happened. That person looks better. There's no incision, like whatever it is. There's something about the results that really speaks to it. But then it's when you start breaking down and digesting how that happens that things really get different. And, you know, I was an athlete growing up, still am now. Yeah, lots of sports. But,
okay.
you know, it was like soccer when I was young. Then it was golf in college. Then I was an elite triathlete. And I do martial arts a lot now. So there's just like been all these things. But through that, I've really gotten into this like athlete's mindset. That's mm-hmm. how I sort of live my life, too, is preparation, execution, recovery, right? And I do that for myself in a big way, which I think helps my results. And I do that for my patients in a big way, which makes their whole experience better. And in the end, their results better. And so for myself in preparation, like there's all the things I do every day. I am trying to get at absolute peak performance when I'm in the operating room. So for your procedure today, I've been preparing all week. I visualize through what we're gonna do. I visualize through our outcomes. That's like called process and outcome visualization. I know exactly sort of what we're gonna do. I have it's all laid out. So I've had all that done. I've tailored my workouts, my eating, my sleep, my everything towards being at peak performance today. Then I'm checking it on my metrics and my biometrics to make sure, okay, did I hit what I'm after today? So I'm getting this, I'm in this constant cycle of like breakdown, build up, workouts, everything like that. And then on the day of procedures, I get in like a flow state leading into it, which I will do for you today too. It's a little bit different for everybody, but I'm usually in the hyperbaric chamber in the morning, kind of doing some academic consumption, getting some quiet time. Then I get in the sauna and do like a very specific specific workout to stimulate
in the sauna.
In the sauna. Wow. Yeah. It's, you know, like it's a shorter workout and it's okay. really this like bilateral balance-based movement to stimulate my corpus callosum that connects the two hemispheres of my brain to link it with my body. So then as
like same thing that like racket sports will do.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of thing.
Yep. And I have a lot of different ways that I do it. I try to keep that a little bit fresh. It's not the same thing every time, but
Overall, is it pretty like consistent, the regimen, the routine that you follow
daily,
or does it change?
The variability comes in like what I'm reading in the hyperbaric chamber. I'll mix that up a little bit, and then in the workout that I'm doing. But similar like durations of all these things and like how much time I'm in the sauna and when I do the workout, how long that is. But I'll break it up a little bit and, you know, I'll learn something new about like how like lights or like stimulus in different hands will like help to stimulate the two sides of our brain and play with those types of things. But
interesting.
But that gets me in my flow state.
And do you do all of these things every day or just when you're preparing for a procedure?
So interesting question. The flow state is like just for surgery.
Okay.
Because getting into a flow state is difficult. Now I'm way better at it than I used to be. Like I kind of can get this rolling, but, and if we've all been in a flow state, we know what it feels like to be in there. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But it's also very taxing and energetically expensive and requires a big recovery afterwards. You cannot do it every day. I can't do it four times a day, which is why generally I'm doing one procedure a day. Like this is my quality over quantity thing. Like for you, it's like I'm in flow for you. I'm all in. I'm so focused. I get down to then I am shot basically after that. I need to recover.
What's the norm for in plastic surgery? Like how many procedures surgeries are plastic surgeons doing daily, weekly?
Yeah, and I think that this is the call to all surgeons really in some sense, but there's surgeons who are doing, you know, like 8, 6, 8, 10 cases a day. And you cannot tell me, and people will argue, but you cannot tell me that on your 8th surgery of the day, you're as sharp as you were for one or two. Like I mean,
that right there kind of explains like why we are seeing so many botched surgeries and probably why a lot of people come to you to fix their prior surgeries and treatments.
Yeah, I mean, that can certainly be a factor. And again, that's pervasive in all types of surgery. It could be appendices or orthopedic surgeons or whatever like types of procedures. It's just sort of how the health system works a little bit. And I think that's a little bit broken. And that, thankfully, I have the luxury to kind of choose my schedule and what I want to do. And I try to keep it into that. There's also a side note, there's a big relationship part of this for me too. Like every patient that I work with is like, we are enmeshed in my brain forever. It's not like you're my fourth surgery of the day, do it, high five, see you later. It's not that. These are people that I'm in long-term relationship with afterwards. And so I obviously want that to be happy, you know, people that I give a lot to. And then, you know, I want the best for everybody. And so, you know, like when we do your procedure today, like we're now like this forever to some degree and just depending on needs. And for some people that, you know, they disappear into their normal life again and I'm just sort of like in the wind. But for other people, I, you know, have more contact with them and things afterwards. But
that's really cool.
You know, that's another reason to kind of keep things manageable for me from like who I work with. I'm very choosy about that, which again is a luxury to get to do that.
Do you ever turn patients away?
Oh yeah, all the time.
For what reasons?
Lots of reasons. Sometimes what they're after is, there may be like, let's just say unrealistic expectations. Sometimes what they're after is so, and this gets a little bit to where I have to work with them, but sometimes the juice isn't worth the squeeze a little bit, if you will. Like it takes a big procedure to get this little change that they're after and it may not be worth doing that. Or the most common situation is just like somebody wants to do sort of like one thing. Like, well, all I'm concerned about is my neck and jawline. Okay. Your entire face is sinking on top of that neck and jawline. If we just do that one thing, that would be super problematic for you. And it will look really funny and will create basically like a tight area where everything else is sinking down. We have a name for that. It's called a lateral sweep deformity. Really common scenario. Somebody's 65 years old. Well, I only want my neck and jawline done. Shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And that might get into this question about like a common mistake that I see or whatever, but that would be a reason to say no. Or sometimes it's just like, I just don't think I'm the right fit for you from a personality standpoint or whatever it may be. And I try to screen that out long before the person's taken too much time into, you know, investing in me. It's like, usually that's, I can pick a lot of that up in the screening process. And people get upset, but honestly, it's more of a favor, like that we're both not going down the road to do that. And, you know, it works. I hope that person finds somebody that they're after, or sometimes I'm doing them a favor by just saying like, this probably isn't something you should pursue at all.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, I usually try to be really explicit about that in a kind way.
With facial fat transfer, where do you take the fat from?
Yeah, it's a really common question. I individualize that a little bit. So again, in the stem cell quest, I'm looking for the areas that tend to be the most stem cell dense. For most people, that's around our abdomen, sort of in the front, or the flanks on the side, especially for men in that area, and then in the medial and sometimes even the lateral thighs. So try to keep it, it's like close to the core, if we will. That's really where those best areas are. So I really take that on an individual basis. So we examine where things are best and we go there. In doing that, I think importantly is I'm a facial guy, right? So I'm not doing any purposeful body contouring. I actually don't want you to know that I was there when all is said and done. It's very even, it's very subtle. It's kind of leave no trace idea with where we're getting it from.
Do some people try to talk you into like, just take a little bit more?
All the time. Well, and you know, I have again, in the selection bias, I tend to have like just a higher fitness type of population. So I'm very accustomed to working with people, very low body fat, even like single digits, bodybuilders, things like that, can always get the fat that I need. It's usually better fat. So when somebody has just a little bit, it's very high quality. That fat's like been through a lot. It's, you know, it perseveres.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of fat that I want to get. And so, you know, wherever it's best to take it from is what I'm shooting for, really.
And can it migrate on the face once you've added that volume back to the face with the fat?
Yeah, this is a great juxtaposition to filler, where I was talking about filler moving and migrating, because filler is just sort of this free-floating implant. Fat transfer needs a blood supply to survive. So when the fat's put in, I mentioned those stem cells get activated by the stress of moving, and they start this process called angioneogenesis, making new blood vessels is what that boils down to. And in that process, they're creating adhesions for themselves. They're creating this inflow of blood. And once that happens, they can't move. They'd die, basically, because they're set in place inside those fat pads. And, you know, they have that nice container of the fat pad to live in anyway.
I heard a podcaster who's had this done talk about how her surgeon said that she needed to eat more for like the following months so that she would retain the fat. Is that true?
That is not something that I counsel my patients to do in that way. I want you to live your normal lifestyle. That doesn't mean it's probably the time to overly stress your fat more than you would at a baseline. But again, most of my patients are already stressing their fat in a normal way anyway, and their fat's gonna be just fine in the transfer process. So for the first few days postoperatively or whatever it may be, you're gonna take it easy anyway. You're not gonna go murder yourself in the gym, but I'm not telling people to hold back. It's a quality of life issue at that point, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love your approach of rejuvenation versus transformation. And I know you don't do surgeries that give people something they never had. Like you don't do nose jobs, for example.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that philosophy?
Yeah. And this would be sort of a line in plastic surgery that most things fit pretty neatly into. And that would be a transformation is, again, like you said, making you something that you never were before. And a rhinoplasty or a nose job is a really great example of that. Somebody has something very simple, a dorsal hump that they don't like. They've had it their whole life. They want to get rid of it. Awesome. Like that's a transformation. That's turning into something you want. Or a breast augmentation usually is that too, turning into something that you never were before. Those aren't bad. Those can improve your quality of life, your confidence, how you carry yourself. Awesome. Great. Not my world as much. That's not the one I live in. I live in more of a world of rejuvenation. And so I would define that more as turning back the hands of time, turning you into something that you were before. Battling aging a little bit is really what that is. And so you have some small degree of aging, not a ton, but not none either, right? So we're going to rejuvenate that today. I will not turn you into something that you never were before. It's going to be this little turn back of the clock. And that for me just adheres to my personal values, my mission a little bit, and same with my patients, right? Works really well. It gives me tangible metrics. It gives me real targets to hit too. So oftentimes I'll be asking for younger pictures of people if they're having something very specific that they're after, and I can look right at exactly where they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And I'm not necessarily trying to hit a number of years ago, but it gives me an idea of the delta, the change, and how the progression and trajectory that things have gone, which is really, really nice. In the transformation world, that's more difficult because you're sort of like shooting at this amorphous, never having existed target before.
Yeah.
We're all on this curve of aging. Everybody is, where we're in our 20s and then it starts, you know, as time ticks forward, it moves down. And I think we might even talk about what those slopes look like. And so I'm really just trying to slide people back up the slope in time. But I want to keep them on the slope. If I've gone to a point that they were never on, I've transformed them a little bit, and it's not what I'm about doing.
Yeah, I love that approach. And the things that I consider with different treatments and procedures are like one, like toxicity, is it safe, is it healthy, is this going to actually like improve the health of my skin overall, or is there like, am I making a concession in some way in order to get like a temporary result or a fleeting result maybe? Or like, I think that we're seeing way too many people that are totally altering their appearance. And I think there's something really cool and special about just looking the way God made you to look. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming less and less common. So I love the idea of just like rejuvenating and kind of like slowing the aging process a bit in a healthy way.
Right.
That actually impacts the skin health, like the health of the skin positively over time. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really cool approach.
Yeah, and there's a whole structure of that skin that we're really shooting for, and it's where the regenerative part really comes in too, because that helps me on my quest to rejuvenate. It's just, you know, quite literally using physiology stem cells to help in that rejuvenation process in ways that nothing else can really do. Surgery can't even do it.
You know,
surgery's not rejuvenating in the same way from a structural standpoint.
How do you prepare your patients for the procedures, and what do you do after the procedures to help them recover?
Yeah, this really fits into that athlete's mindset too of preparation, execution, and recovery. And this is where recovery really gets big for them. For me, recovery is like, okay, you know, back to tomorrow if I have to operate again or whatever it may be. For my patients, in preparation, interestingly now, this has evolved for me over a, you know, a decade of where my patients are coming into me. So I've always really focused on getting them preoperatively ready for their surgery. I want them coming in with their inflammatory and their antioxidant profiles dialed in as optimized as they can be, right? So that may mean specific dietary recommendations, even like what cleaners they're using in their homes. And I've seen the evolution of that just happening naturally. So a lot of people who are watching your podcast are going to be doing that already, right? So what used to be a huge emphasis, I call this like pre-covery, which is not a real word, but I've made that up. And I call this pre-covery, like getting ready before they come in. It's just the more people I talk to are doing things, and I'm learning from them. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Like things that they're doing. So that's kind of phase one before they ever get to me. There's a lot of preparation that goes into all my 100% of my patients travel to see me.
And 100%.
So 100%. Wow. I mean, there's a few exceptions to that where maybe people who like are local or have a home, but in all intents and purposes, it's about 100%. So there's that whole part of this pre-experience as well. And we have a whole team dedicated just to that, right? And then there's the execution phase is pretty simple when you're a patient. It's just sort of, you know, you're asleep. That's very different too. How I execute that portion is a lot of regenerative medicine intraoperatively while we're actually working. When you're asleep, it's a whole different animal than how you might experience it. I'm not using general anesthesia for any of the procedures that I'm doing. In our IV sedation that we use, I do not use any opioid medications at all, which is very much not the norm. I don't use any benzodiazepines, which is very much not the norm. I want things to be super neurocognitively protective for my patients. You're young, you're healthy, you're having an elective procedure done. I am not going to blunt your long-term neurocognition over something like that. It also makes the recovery as we transition to that much, much easier because you're able to go to the bathroom better if you don't have opioids. You're thinking more clearly, a lot of really nice aspects of that. Pain control becomes part of that too. Last thing I do in the procedure is long-acting nerve blocks. Most of what I'm doing during the procedure is local anesthesia-based, right? So you're asleep, but I'm also, you're never getting a pain signal sent from whatever I'm doing to your brain. It's blocked at the site, which we know, data-backed, even in general anesthesia, makes the recovery easier because if that pain signal never goes to the brain in the first place, that sort of pathway isn't primed, if you will. So when you wake up from surgery, you don't have as much pain if you block it at the site. So it's becoming hopefully a little bit more in trend with general surgery, general anesthesia to localize, to put local anesthesia where you're working so that the, you know, doesn't have as much pain afterwards. So I've been taking advantage of that for a long time. And the very last thing I do is long acting local nerve blocks. And those last about 48 or 72 hours. Most postoperative pain happens in the first 24. So we are well through that time frame by the time there's any sort of resumption of sensation. And so again, 90-ish, 95% of my patients need zero pain pills after the procedures that we're doing.
Wow.
Which is remarkable, awesome, good for both of us, good for them, better experience, better recovery. It's a much...
And pretty unheard of, right? Set of,
yeah, that's not the norm at all. Like something I talk about a lot and try to teach about, but definitely not the normal. It just takes, honestly, it takes the mindset to care to do that type of thing.
Yeah.
So that would be sort of the execution of how I roll with my patients. So then even, you know, the philosophy of like the types of approaches I take, I do as many things as minimally invasive as possible. I try to take advantage of this Pareto principle that's like, if I can get 80% of the result with 20% of the input, it's probably what we're going to do. And the real magic happens in understanding all the various things that need to be done to achieve this outcome. So you come to me, you have a desire that you want. My job is to then understand all the factors that contribute and then take this sort of Pareto principle with all those factors and then achieve this wonderful result that there's no scars, nothing looks different. The person just looks better and more refreshed. Nothing is overdone, but also nothing is left behind. And I'll see that a lot with eyelid surgery, say, where somebody's had an eyelid surgery somewhere else. It's okay. You know, they got a 7 out of 10 result. Maybe not what they wanted, but it's okay. Usually what I'm seeing is that there was just this one little aspect that was left on the table that was unrecognized by the other surgeon or unaddressed, whatever it may have been. Like there may be a little bit of an eye asymmetry. One eye is a little smaller than the other that they didn't fix or something like that. And so now they have this eyelid surgery, but their eyes are still asymmetrical. It's like, well, that was just a little miss with your last surgery. And so that's a lot of the fixes that I do are just, they're not disasters. They're just minor things like that.
Yeah.
Then in the recovery phase, that's where things really get different. That's like my whole protocol that I'm like constantly working on, tinkering with, making better, testing out, using evidence. And, you know, that's a whole protocol where, again, everybody's traveling. So I have them for 7 days or 10 days afterwards. And we're using hyperbaric oxygen and specific IV nutrition. And what I mean is I usually have your genetic profile before you come. And so I know your nutrigenomics and how we're going to make your IVs for you, even customized to the type of procedure you have. They're doing pulsed electromagnetic fields. We're doing very specific types of photobiomodulation with red light or LED light in different wavelengths, depending on the procedure you had. So lots to that recovery. And that's like incredible from a getting better faster standpoint. Mm-hmm. So it just expedites the recovery. But in the end, the results are better too. And that's where, again, I'm chasing like these single digit percentage points in everything that I'm doing. The devil's in the details. And that's definitely one of them. So better faster, better results, total win-win, and a really unique part of my practice for sure.
I want to talk through decade by decade what happens as we age. So I'm going to start kind of in the 20s, but I first want to hear from you. What do you think is the number one cause of premature aging?
Oh, I'm going to get a little technical, but let's just say aging in general, especially when we're talking about our skin, is going to be oxidative damage. And that's like a super, I'm hedging that answer quite a bit because that's a very broad answer. And oxidative damage can happen from sunshine. Mm-hmm. It can happen from smoking. Can happen from poor overall health. So that's gonna be my answer because it's very individualized as to what that is. But a lot of it boils down to that as the sub detail, it's oxidative damage.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then just depending on what the person is exposed to the most, like what that area of oxidative stress is in their life, maybe it's different for everyone,
right?
But everyone on some level is aging more quickly because of some type of oxidative stress.
100%. And it can be stress, can be the water you're drinking, could be like all these little minor details can play into that, you know. And but there's a lot of other factors that go into it, even genetic things, of course, but that would be probably the common theme for premature aging.
Makes sense. Okay, so starting in the 20s, what signs of aging do people in their 20s start to experience?
Yeah, thankfully the 20s is one of our flatter decades when we think of the curves, right? 80s, 90s, 20s are pretty flat, but 20s and 30s, 20s are setting up the 30s, we'll say, a little bit. So there's things happening that just aren't noticed as much. On our skin, from a structural level, we're losing collagen and elastin at some point, mid-20s and beyond, right? For women, estrogen levels are still high. Progesterone levels are still high. For men, testosterone levels are still high. So sex hormones are wildly important to our aging process. That's one of the reasons that things are a little bit flatter. Muscles are moving our skin. And you may start to see your first little signs of wrinkles that you didn't have. Like my 10-year-old and 9-year-old, when they move, they barely make a wrinkle at all, even though if they're really moving, because their skin's so strong and it can stand up to that muscular tension. But you might start to see those first little signs forming in your 20s. Definitely start to accumulate some oxidative damage. But one of the big ones is actually in the substructure, right? So we have our skin, that's the envelope that we're really talking about. And underneath our fat pads, I always kind of say they're like pushing up, they're holding up the skin from below. And as you start to get the first aging changes in your fat pads, you might notice a little bit of loss of support on your skin, a little bit of contour change on the surface. For some people, that's starting to happen in their late 20s. But again, a pretty flat decade from an aging standpoint.
What do you think about preventative Botox?
Yeah.
These young women who are starting to get preventative Botox in their 20s.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more neutral about this in general than I would say I am with filler. When Botox is well understood as to what it does, Botox immobilizes or weakens muscles. Sometimes it full-on paralyzes them. Sometimes it just makes them not as strong, depending on the doses it's used in. But it helps to take tension off the skin surface. Like I said, when my 10-year-old moves, you know, he's got a ton of force on there, but his skin can stand up to it. If you do that when you're 65, you're going to make a lot of wrinkles, right? So you can, in the interim between those two, you can start to weaken or soften those muscular force contractions and take tension off the skin. So when you get to that, from a preventative standpoint, you do want to start before you have significant wrinkles, probably at those little first signs where like, uh-oh, my skin's starting to lose this battle. You weaken, it's like a tug of war. You weaken one side of the tug of war, right? But then you get into all kinds of other things. And again, I'm more neutral on these. It's a toxin. You're taking away some of your natural facial expression by definition when you're using Botox. Maybe you don't care if you can scowl and show that emotion, but you're taking away a nonverbal communication and an emotion. And I would say the one thing with the Botox, and Botox is Botox, Dysport, Xeom, and Daxxify. There's a bunch of brands of it. We call them neuromodulators. The one thing I feel really strongly about, and this is a very personal thing, is if you have a little kid, a baby, a toddler, somebody who a predominant amount of your communication with them is nonverbal, I think you should not be taking away that ability to communicate with them by immobilizing these important parts of your expression, right?
Interesting.
I think that the emotional and the nonverbal and the communication development of our kids revolves a little around, think of a baby, around what they're seeing in your face. Mm-hmm. You're their mom. It's your expression, right?
Yeah.
I think dads too, I mean, to put that in there, but especially moms, if you have a baby, I think you should be doing it.
Yeah.
You should be doing it when you're breastfeeding anyway, but even if you're not breastfeeding, I think those emotions are really important to show in that animation. So my little lens and a total side note, but that'd be the one, like I would say, don't do it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That totally makes sense to me. And you touched on the concept of toxic load a little bit. This is something that we talk about in this world where we are exposed to so many toxins, oftentimes at a rate that is quicker than we can detox from them. Mm-hmm. Does that concern you at all with Botox?
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of them we don't even know we're exposed to, right? That's a whole nother podcast. But it plays into that, right? So there is, because your toxin load is mathematical, basically. Like, how bad is a toxin? How frequently are you exposed to it? How many other toxins are you exposed to? What's your inherent capacity to detoxify these things? Which is, again, I know this for my patients when they're coming in because I have their genetic profiles. I know how good they are at detoxing, which is a total side note. But yeah, I mean, you're adding to that load, certainly. We do have a way to break it down. That's why Botox is not a permanent solution. It does get broken down, and it adds to that, you know, overall load. So I think it's relatively small in its dose to do that, but it is 100% part of that mathematical equation.
Yeah. I'm seeing a lot more anecdotal stories now of different podcasters, people in the beauty world that are starting to come out and say that they have experienced Botox poisoning themselves. Mm. And so it's something that I'm just like always interested in getting different perspectives on.
Yeah. I think that a little bit of a selection bias for that, for sure. We'll see what happens, I think, without them. Botox has been around for a long, long time.
What do you mean by selection bias?
It's very interesting to talk about. You know, you're going to get a lot of attention and exposure by talking about something like that, but it'd be difficult to quantify what that is. And, you know, again, for something that's been around
like what
for
percentage
so
of the population.
Yeah, or what Botox toxicity is, you know, mm-hmm. And what else is it paired with? What other mycotoxins or heavy metals or things do you have? Like, how does it fit into that? Again, that mathematical equation, what's happening with it.
What are your thoughts on facial massage for preventing wrinkles or patches that women are wearing at night to prevent wrinkles?
Yeah, this gets into that kind of what's happening through the decades a little bit, right? And facial massage is, we know that we're having degeneration or loss of structure of our tissue. That's really what's leading to the aging changes in our face. Massaging the face, facial exercises, there's a lot of studies trying to look at if this is going to have any appreciable effect on what's happening. And interestingly, we know that mechanical forces are one of the things that can break tissue down or build it up, depending on how it's applied and what tissue it's applied to. So I think that the jury's still out a little bit. It's not gonna move the needle a lot in either direction, in my opinion. Same with like facial exercises.
I think that it can make a difference if you do it very consistently in terms of facial massage. Mm-hmm. Don't have experience with, but I think that it's not something that you'll do and, you know, once a week and it's going to make a big difference for you. But it does make sense to me that if you are massaging the fascia and boosting circulation in that way, that it would be good for the tissue and like healthy, something that would really help to do long term.
Yeah, there's a big confounding variable here with that, and that is what happens with the lymphatics, right? That is where improving lymphatic drainage, we know, is, let's just say, good for tissue. That kind of tends to be the limiting factor for a lot of the flow from, you know, it's getting extravasated out of our blood into the surrounding soft tissue, then cleared away. That's certainly an area where even like recovery from surgery or recovery from life is improved with massage, right? But I just, it's the long term. What is that doing long term? We know that there's an immediate benefit to doing that for sure. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay, I think another thing that a lot of people in their 20s start to look into are chemical peels and photofacials. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, and so with chemical peels, that's another idea of a little micro injury to the skin, in this case using a chemical to disrupt the skin surface and stimulate a response that builds a little bit of collagen or adds a little bit back to, like most of our injury responses in our skin create some new collagen, or as we get to better ways to create new elastin tissue. That's what we really want to create.
Interesting. Okay. Moving into the 30s, I know that is when I started to notice a lot more visible signs of aging in my skin, especially around my eyes.
Yeah.
So what is typical for people to experience in their 30s, and what can we start to do about those changes?
Yeah, eyes are like one of the first areas that show it. And anatomically, that's the thinnest skin on our body, right around our eyes. It's like 100 microns, 0.1 millimeters thick, and there's no subcutaneous fat there. Mm. That very thin skin lives right on top of a muscle, and that muscle is highly mobile, so it breaks down faster, right? That would be an area where Botox could help prevent that if it was used preemptively. So that would be where you really see people, or where I really see people seeking out their first, you know, reaching out as far as like, what can I do from this anti-aging perspective?
Yeah, I know a lot of people my age are starting to do microneedling treatments. What are your thoughts on microneedling?
Microneedling is a great entry point into skin rejuvenation because it's taking that little micro injury that we talked about and just upping it a little bit into some depths of the skin. Does a good job to create an injury without much of a byproduct. It's better when it's done with growth factors applied, something like PRP that a lot of people have heard of, which stands for platelet-rich plasma. That's growth factors that we take out of your own blood. And the reason that it's better for that is because of this little thing I mentioned before. This is going to become a theme as we move forward, is it's really easy to create collagen. Cuts, scars, injuries create collagen. We really want to create elastin tissue. Elastin is a much more delicate part of our skin. It's what gives it the elasticity, as the name would imply. It's much more prone to sun damage, oxidative damage. It's harder to recreate it once it's gone. And something like these growth factors, when they're applied, whether it's after a microneedling or after a laser, can upregulate the creation of this elastin in comparison to collagen.
That was what I was going to ask you about. So do you think that these treatments like microneedling or lasers that create these little injuries in the skin, do you think they can be detrimental if they aren't paired with a growth factor of some sort?
They're going to be less robust if they're not paired with the growth factor, and you're going to get a different concentration of collagen to elastin, but not from a detrimental standpoint.
It's not going to pull from like your skin's nutrient stores over time if you're like continuously injuring the skin without like helping it to repair.
Yeah, you'll see when somebody sort of overdoes it, and that would be maybe on an individual treatment standpoint versus repeating multiple treatments. Our skin's relatively good at regenerating. It's wildly rich with stem cells from our skin surface. We can, for example, we can treat your skin with a laser in a very different fashion than we can treat even your neck and chest. It responds so much better. So when somebody goes overboard with treatments, it's usually on those individual treatments, and then they get more collagen than elastin, say, and that changes the composition of how that skin moves naturally because it becomes more structural and rigid than it does elastic.
Mm. Okay, and what about lasers? The world of lasers is so complicated and confusing. Can you like break down lasers, like categories, subcategories? Yep. Yeah. How do they work?
This device topic is huge, right? So lasers is an acronym for light amplification by stimulated emission radiation. Light. Those are light-based things. One single wavelength by definition, and that wavelength has a target in our skin. That target reacts to that single wavelength of light and we create our effect. It's usually heat that causes that. Then we have other devices like these microneedling radio frequency devices, right? With all of them, I'm gonna say if anything promises to lift, run. Don't walk, run away.
What about tightening?
Tightening, same thing, the magic bullet. We're not gonna tighten and lift and cause elevation, right? There's these like micro changes of tightening that happen, but that should not be the reason you are doing these devices. If that's what's being sold to you, get away. It's not gonna work. And if you're lucky, it does nothing. If you're unlucky, it's gonna damage you in that process in an attempt to lift and tighten, right? Not a great idea. These are focused on skin quality. That's what they should be focused on. This is the envelope. This is fine wrinkles, pigmentation, broken blood vessels. That is what we can do really well with lasers, right? Because I have a laser that targets blood vessels, and I have a different laser that targets pigment, and I have a different laser that targets fine wrinkles.
How many lasers do you have?
A lot. Yeah, a lot. And so for you today, you might use three different ones or something like that. And that's why I call this a laser cocktail, because for everybody, I'm mixing them up a little bit of a different cocktail depending on what their individual needs are.
Yeah, that's amazing. So something that I am very excited about, maybe the most excited about today, is that I will be going home with a jar of baby balm, mm-hmm. Primally Pure baby balm, mixed with my own stem cells.
Yes.
And that's something that you do for almost every patient that comes through your door.
Yes.
With their own stem cells.
Yes.
Why is our baby balm such a good fit to pair with their stem cells and mix and help with recovery?
I was so excited to find your particular product, which is actually kind of random, right? It was long
so
before
random.
This.
Yeah.
And so when I'm done with my patients, I've disrupted their skin with the laser, usually, right? And I also have access to their stem cells because we did fat transfer. This is almost universal across the board with every procedure and surgery that I do, right? I want them, I'm using their stem cells during the procedure, but for about 3 days afterwards, our skin is very receptive to external applications of things. We can use this to deliver drugs, which we call percutaneous drug delivery, and the laser makes that better. Well, it's the same with stem cells, right? So now I have this perfect bed to be putting stem cells on, and I needed a vehicle for somebody to be able to apply their own stem cells afterwards. And tallow is the closest thing that we can get to sort of our own oil or sebum that our skin makes.
Yeah,
and our face
it's
very
biocompatible.
Right. And our face is the ultimate producer of that sebum, right? So it's an excellent moisturizer. The fatty acid profile of it is perfect, dang near perfect for our own sebum, right? And that's when you get into the palmitic and oleic acids and all these wonderful things, stearic acid that are in there. But then there's this one in particular, conjugated linoleic acid, which is like antioxidant and antibacterial. So now, from as somebody who doesn't want to take an antibiotic after their procedure, which is mostly based off that skin change, I have a little bit of that mixed in as well. So I have this perfect, wonderful, beautiful vehicle for these stem cells to get applied that has benefits of its own. And then honestly, just from a logistics standpoint, emulsifies really well with the stem cells from with your own stem cells to go for this topical application afterwards.
Let's get into the 40s, 50s, 60s and beyond. What signs of aging are people dealing with in those decades and how do you address them?
Yeah, these are good decades to link together because it's kind of a lot of the same happening, but some big changes happen in there with kids, stress, and sex hormones that happen. So stress ages us, changing in our sex hormones, especially for women around perimenopause, which is a little bit redundant to say perimenopause, but it's just this like title that exists now.
And when does that start to happen?
Everyone's a little bit different, but it's a spectrum too. It's not just a straight turnoff, right? So late 40s through early mid and into the late 50s. So that kind of that central decade of this three decades we're talking about is really where a lot of it's happening. And that's there's more distinct changes that happen in there and very commonly. So people will notice things happening in their 40s. A lot of it's people that have a genetic predisposition to something and then it starts to meet aging. So maybe you have a little bit of a genetic predisposition to lower eyelid bags and now your aging catches up and boom, you have lower eyelid bags. Okay, there it is. That's like a very common, you know, sort of first contact for me. But I also see, especially women who get to a point where they say, I feel like I've fallen off a cliff from an aging standpoint. Most commonly when that happens, it's perimenopause paired with some stressful life event happening almost simultaneously.
Is there a way to kind of ease that transition a little bit so it isn't as like harsh? Is there anything women can do?
Yeah, this gets into a whole topic that I like to refer my patients for about different types of hormone replacement, stress management, whatever that may be. Cortisol wreaks havoc on our soft tissue. We know that inside and out. That's our stress hormone, right? Same with the sex hormone, complex interactions, especially when they're present or decreasing together. And so, yes, the answer is yes in the short sense. That's a whole nother, again, a whole nother podcast to kind of go into what that is to really adhere to it. And so I'll see patients on or off of, say, something like hormone replacement therapy. And I know that the trajectory of their aging after we're done even will be a little bit dependent on what happens there.
Okay.
So those are usually the decades where gravity starts to take its first effect. This is our first conversation about gravity a little bit. We have these ligaments in our face that quite literally hold. We talked about the glide planes and the fat pads in the musculature. Well, those are connected to the underlying bone via these very discrete ligaments. Those ligaments start to experience laxity and fade a little bit over time. That's where we start talking about options to lift and actually tighten those ligaments up a little bit. There's lots of different ways to do that. I tend to adhere to a very, 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 in the scope of things, minimally invasive way to do that. I like to go right underneath the ligaments themselves, put fat pads back where they go, keep things as small and minimally invasive as possible, not even in the same boat as a lot of the old school procedures that people might think of from like a facelift standpoint.
Yeah, what actually happens in a traditional facelift procedure?
Yeah.
I've heard it's a little bit crazy.
Well, so with a traditional, like let's say brow lift, everybody thinks of this old brow lift where there's an incision that like we call it a coronal, it goes ear to ear, the whole brow is pulled up, you look surprised, so far away from that now, not even close. Teeny little incisions hidden back in the hairline, can't even find them when we're all said and done, right? So just a whole different avenue, not even the 80-20 at that point. We're talking like the 105, you know, percentage input there. And then a traditional facelift would be, you know, incisions in and around the ears with a separation of the skin from the underlying fat, and then trying to pull on the fat pads from above, even though the ligaments are holding them from down deep and trying to tighten them up. Doesn't look great. It's not the right way to do it. That's called a SMAS facelift. Not my favorite way to do it.
Is that what most surgeons are still doing?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I'll tend to take more minimally invasive incisions, sometimes even the same one in the temple that we're talking about, and I'll go underneath the fat pads, which then leaves the skin and the fat connected to each other as they're supposed to be. That's not supposed to be a glide plane. That's not supposed to be separated. I'll go into the little glide planes underneath the fat pads, right to the ligaments, lift, tighten the ligaments, I don't want to take the artistry out of all this, but I'm really looking at where the fat pads are and where they used to be, and I'm just moving them back and fixing them there in as minimally invasive a way as possible.
From one little incision.
Well, and it looks, everybody's a little bit different in what their access needs are, right? If you're 45 and we're talking about a light little lifting procedure, it's a whole different animal than if you're 75 and we're talking about it, because at that point there's skin needs that need to be lifted and tailored and removed. And so regardless of who you are, where you're at, it's going to be the most minimally invasive option that we have to hit those goals and achieve that nice cohesive result that we're after. For a lot of my patients, as I mentioned, who've had prior filler, whether it's problematic or not, this is our opportunity to be removing that filler, because I'm visualizing it, I'm seeing it, it's right in front of me. So I can manually, instead of trying to bathe it in this enzyme, I can manually scoop it out or take it out from where it is. And then again, we're usually replacing with fat at that time. So it's kind of that, it's a whole different type of a reset to do it in that way.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Radio frequency treatments are sometimes referred to as an instant facelift. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is what we sort of were chatting about a little bit before with those devices. If a device is promising to lift or tighten, run, don't walk, threads are going to fall in this category too, which we haven't really talked about it as much yet.
Those are awful.
They're everywhere. They're all over.
And painful.
Yeah, we just know. Like I mentioned, even with the old facelift style, if you're not releasing the ligaments and you're just trying to pull from the top, even during a surgery, it's going to fail. It's not going to work that well. Let alone if you're just trying to insert these from external through the skin and think that they're going to lift up. And it's another thing that I have to deal with a little bit from a problematic standpoint during surgery.
Yeah, I bet. I want to leave our listeners with some accessible tips to improve their skin health. What are your top lifestyle habits or it can be diet related, anything that just improves skin health naturally.
Yeah, this is where I get really boring into just the things that they're probably doing a lot of already. So I have to say, from a sun standpoint, that my colleagues may crucify me a little bit, I am not anti-sun at all. I want sun, I get sun, it's important to us. I just try to make that at times that are a little bit more amenable to limiting my oxidative damage. So I'm doing it when the sun is low, early in the morning, late at night, definitely getting that. But on here where we live, July 1st, I may not be out at noon sunbathing. That's probably one of the biggest things. And then getting into the other oxidative damage types of things. So I think that exercise, detoxifying in the sauna, those are all wonderful ways to just improve your overall skin health. And then this is where you can get into looking at your genetic age, your metabolic age. Those are going to affect, especially from a skin standpoint, how you're aging in those ways. So pay attention to that and look at the levers that you can uniquely pull based on maybe off your genetic profiling. And that's gonna give you the best bang for your buck as far as efforts to slow down the aging process.
I love what you said about the sun. I think so many of us have been conditioned to just avoid the sun at all costs, mm-hmm. but to me, it makes so much more sense to take a common sense approach to sun exposure.
Right.
And, you know, respecting it, not like being irresponsible and going out and just baking in the sun for endless hours, but also not avoiding it at all costs.
Right.
Why do you think dermatologists are so bent on completely avoiding the sun? Was it just ingrained into them so much in their training?
Yeah, it's one of those cognitive thought biases that I see, that when you have to kind of be okay with the worst case scenario of things when you deal with them. And the worst case scenario of too much sun or sun for the wrong person at the wrong times is can be really significant, can be deadly too, right? If we're talking about skin cancer here, and it's the most common cancers in the world for a reason. And that is, those dermatologists are seeing a gigantic sampling error of skin cancers.
But there's also more contributing to that, right?
Just absolutely.
Lifestyle choices, diet, inflammatory foods.
100%, 100%, yes. But the big driver is
the
sun. That's the common, you know, denominator between all of those. That's why I think, just getting to the root of this answer, that's why I think from a dermatologist standpoint, somebody who's treating a lot of skin cancer is gonna be a little bit more cautious about it, because they've seen where the rubber meets the road a little bit there. Mm-hmm.
What is the number one thing that you think most plastic surgeons get wrong?
I think it is not looking at the patient's concerns as a whole, meaning taking into account upstream and downstream effects of what they're after. And I hinted at this a little bit earlier in a common scenario with, I just want my jawline and my neck tightened and I'm 62 years old. If that is the perceived, and this is really common, like, I want to make you happy, right? So you tell me you want a lower face and neck lift and that's what you want to be happy, and I execute that. Okay, well, that part makes you happy. But when we look at the end product, there's a problem with it. Sometimes I find that people don't even notice that there's a problem. They don't even know that they look kind of off or funny. They're just thrilled that they had something done and it looks different, right?
But different isn't always better.
Yes.
As you say that.
Yes. This is like, I tell everybody this with before and after photos. Look at, and fillers the same way. Just because it's different doesn't mean it's better. And so I would rather take that huge effort on the lower face and distribute it throughout the entire face to be a little bit less dramatic, but make everything look better as a cohesive unit. Because you didn't just age in your face and neck. Everything's aging at a similar pace. And so I think that that's how things should be addressed a little bit. So I'd say that's one of the most common things. And it's just, I think, a miss of the multiple factors that contribute. I talked a little bit about this with eyelids too. When somebody has this sinking called ptosis, this funny P word, where the P is silent, I see it missed all the time. And somebody gets an eyelid surgery that, okay, it's fine, it looks okay, but that one little thing was missed. Yeah. And now we don't have this like nice cohesive understanding, and the results just a little bit off.
I would imagine it would be difficult to hit all of the bases when you are doing 4, 5, 6 surgeries every single day.
Right.
Just kind of have this revolving door of patients coming in and out. Like, you're going to miss things.
And you're just doing what people are asking for. And it takes a lot of time, energy, effort, and relationship to educate somebody on, well, and this is what's bothering you, but we really need to think kind of like top down and how we're going to put all these things together. That's a lot of effort. I talked to somebody yesterday who was telling me, like, in an hour-long virtual consultation, which is how I usually meet people for the very first time. She's like, I've done like 3 of these and the other ones were 5 minutes long.
Wow.
Just telling me what they could do for me. It's just a whole different animal. And that's the paradigm, is like, I do my consults in 10 minutes and I do 5 surgeries a day versus I'm yours when we're consulting. Like, I want to get through everything, every question you have. And then same when it comes to surgery day, like, it's just us and that's all we're doing.
What do you do when you have an off morning, an off day? Like, maybe you didn't sleep great the night before. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that going into a procedure?
Any of those levers that I can pull, I'm controlling in an obsessive manner, to be honest. I can fully admit that I'm obsessed with my results, right? And so I'm going to do the things that it takes to get there that I can pull. But if one of my kids is ill that night and I can't control it, like, okay, I'm going to roll with that. But thankfully, this is the other part I didn't talk about as much, is I'm watching like my resilience as well too, because nothing's ever perfect.
Yeah.
And I want my resilience at such a high level that I can roll with anything that comes at me. That includes in the operating room. When we're talking about revising, filler, I'm going to just choose your own adventure sometime. I have no idea. I can visualize all I want and a surprise will pop up, right? And I have to be able to deal with that. That's where the hard days in the gym come from. That's where all those types of things, like, I am hard to kill. I'm bulletproof. I want to be ready for those resilient situations.
Yeah. I try to take that same approach in life, like taking care of myself, doing the best I can on a consistent basis to build up health and resiliency. And that way, when something is off, it doesn't tank you as much as it would have if you hadn't been putting those deposits in over time on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to get into some fun rapid fire questions with you.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're putting me in a box here. I'm going to do the best I can.
Short answer.
Here we go. I'll do it.
Red light face masks. Yes or no?
I'm going to say yes, but it has to be a financial, can't be a financial burden for you. They do work, but the bang for the buck is a little bit altered there. They're kind of expensive for what they do.
Okay. Silicone patches for preventing wrinkles.
I'm going to say no for preventing wrinkles, but I'm going to say yes for scarring, where there is some minor benefit to using silicone sheeting if you've had an incision or scar. But for wrinkles, not going to do too much.
Okay. Silk pillowcases for preventing wrinkles.
Ooh, I have a house full of silk pillowcases, and I can say no.
Oh my gosh, you threw me off there. Okay. Why do you do them then?
I don't know. They feel nice, but they're not going to anti-age you.
They're not going to hurt.
Yeah.
Collagen peptides.
Ooh. Yes. Evidence-based, yes. There's a whole caveat to that, though, in that I think people think they're going to eat collagen and it's going to get transported to their gut, right to their skin. That's not how it works. It gets broken down into its individual amino acids and then reassembled. I think that if you're eating a normal protein-rich diet, the answer to that is probably not.
Okay.
Didn't do much.
Facial ice baths.
get in the whole ice bath and put your face in. So no. I'm going to say yes to ice. Facial ice baths, get in all the way.
All the way. Okay. Jaw exercises.
Ooh, three categories here. Yes, no, and it doesn't do much. If you are a clencher or a grinder, no, you don't want to be doing more. If you are somebody who doesn't chew a lot, maybe part of your diet doesn't include things that require a lot of that, like stimulation of your jaw, yes, absolutely. But for most of us, we're already getting that jaw stimulation, so it's not going to do too much. Our jaw is just like every other bone. It needs stimulation to stay dense and thick.
What about mouth taping for facial bone structure?
Yeah, I'm going to say yes overall to this because the benefits go well beyond that into nasal cavities, the way that air flows through our nose and gets moisturized, and then the facial structure part of it. So easy yes
there. I love mouth taping. What about biofiller?
I'm going to say no. I'm just going to stop there. let's just say no. Do your autologous, your own fat transfer if you want the best biofiller that exists.
Okay. What about topical peptides?
So different ones, depending on their size, can penetrate well. GHK copper would be a great example of a small one that penetrates really well. I'm going to say yes.
And that's good for hair growth too, I think I've heard.
It is, yep.
Last question. If you could construct the ideal diet for skin health, what would that look like?
This is what I tell my kids all the time. Protein is king, so that's going to be the first things first. Let's just call that. That's the one, really, that everybody's missing.
Yep.
When we really get into the nuances, though, for skin health, it's the fatty acid profiles. That's where things are wildly unique. Kind of like we talked about with the baby balm, right? That's not just a topical thing. We want to be eating that right fatty acid profile, which is why a grass-fed beef tallow is a whole different animal than a non-grass-fed beef tallow. So the fatty acid profile is key, and you can get into vegan, carnivore, whatever. Like, I just like to use common sense, and I look at my teeth, and I know that I have teeth to eat all of those things, so I do. You can't tell me that you should only eat plants or you should only eat meat. That's not true. Look at my mouth. But I think that paying attention to your fatty acid profiles from an omegas, omega-3, omega-6 standpoint, that's wildly off in our diet, and that's going to be wild.
With the prevalence of seed oils.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're not meant to eat that much omega-6. That's not how it goes. And if you look at even, we see the changes in, again, beef, right? Like, what's the fatty acid profile of the beef? It depends on what it eats as well. And those are important to what we're passing on to ourselves. So I'd say focusing on your proper fatty acid profiles, omega-3 heavy versus omega-6 heavy would be the next little like hack to it.
Love it. Dr. Chestnut, thank you so much for this conversation. Thanks for being here. Where can people find you and continue to learn from you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm most active on social media, Instagram primarily, and TikTok. And it's, we'll have the link in there for, it's just my name, MD, Chestnut MD. And there's a lot on there from before and after results, education, a lot of what we talked about. You'll find more in depth on there as well.
Yeah, I love following along with you. You're always a wealth of information and really fun and engaging content too.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Thanks for being here.
It's been fun.